So without further ado, I'd like to start with an economic update. Now, the regular listeners to these sessions will know that one of the hobbies of the economics team, and me in particular, has been getting hold of real-time economic data through the pandemic and really trying to gauge how the economy has been moving forward in as close to real-time as we can. But whilst my appetite for this hasn't waned, I want to have a look today at some official data, because it's been a really big morning for UK economic data since we've had the first official metrics of how the UK economy has fared through the second quarter, what the coronavirus impact has been. And, you know, without much surprise, but nevertheless, rather depressingly, the UK economy has re-entered recession. We've now had it confirmed this morning that we've had two consecutive quarters of negative UK GDP growth. And we had the biggest drop in output over the second quarter since those comparable GDP records began in 1955. That was a drop of 20.4%. It wasn't a million miles away from most forecasters' expectations, but nevertheless, it's a pretty somber headline that we look at this morning. And it's a bigger decline than we saw for other Western economies over the second quarter, you know, even worse than Spain's 18.5% drop. And, you know, partly that reflects the difference in timings through which people entered restrictions and how tight restrictions have been. But nevertheless, even if you take the first half of the year overall, the UK's drop in GDP is still more severe than France's, Italy's, Germany and the US. So we, you know, we have been hit particularly severely, and that in particular reflects the significance of the consumer sector in the UK economy and household spending and its dominance there. So, you know, as we stand looking at these figures at the morning, at the end of the second quarter, real GDP stood back at levels last seen in 2003, with output about 22% below its pre-pandemic peak. So that was, you know, that was the headline from the quarterly numbers. The interesting, more forward-looking bit of this that we got was the full set of monthly figures for this quarter, and the new number today particularly was the June GDP number. June data is important because it tells us how we've moved on as we've moved through that period. So that Q2 drop came basically in April, in an enormous drop in GDP in April. The economy then recovered modestly in May, but then in June, these June figures that we've had this morning showed us that we had an 8.7% recovery. So as we've moved through the phase reopening, as we suspected, but it's now confirmed, the UK economy came off its lows and started to recover. You know, that recovery has been different across the different sectors, and that reflects the way that the restrictions have evolved. But nevertheless, across the set, that recovery is still coming through, you know, slowly but steadily over the period. Of the three major sectors, services actually recovered with the smallest rebound. It's the largest of the UK sectors, but that reflected the fact that the bigger reopening for services actually came after the end of the second quarter. And of course, all of this came ahead of the summer statement with the temporary VAT cut to leisure and hospitality, the Eat Out to Help Out incentive, which has been popular in August, the stamp duty holiday. All of that's come after this Q2 figure. But certainly this has set the tone. So since then, where are we? Well, we don't have the July figures yet, but we strongly suspect, looking at these real-time data that I track pretty closely, that the economy has grown even more in July. The real-time data certainly suggests that. If we look at key surveys, and the purchasing managers' indices showed suggested a strong rebound in July, and particularly for services where we had that bigger reopening of the hospitality sectors. If you look at BRC's retail sales monitor, that again points to a pretty decent recovery coming through, and footfall seems to be coming back on the high streets too. It's interesting if you look at the impact of the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, which became available from August. And that certainly boosted open table restaurant reservation numbers, which were up about 20% year on year for last Wednesday, which was the first Wednesday that you could do it. And it doesn't seem to have displaced other actions. So certainly there seems to be a boost coming through from the summer statement action that we've had from the Chancellor, and transport metrics all telling us the same thing. The recovery is continuing through July, and even with the localised lockdowns, more recovery coming through in August. But, you know, clearly there is a long way to go. And as I said, from these big figures that we've had confirmed this morning, that recovery has a big hill to climb. Now, what are our forecasts? Well, near term, our forecasts still envisage a robust Q3 GDP rise overall. We still suspect that this lopsided V recovery is the most likely, but clearly there is a risk that we get a flatter recovery, perhaps with an overwhelming second wave coming through. That's something that the Chancellor seems to be looking at a bit more now. We've heard him reports that he's thinking about pushing back the autumn budget if we do get that second wave as a way to hold back some of his fiscal power. So in terms of the numbers, well, with our forecast, we'd still see GDP down maybe 3.5%, but there's obviously a lot of uncertainty in the numbers at the moment, but still perhaps around that far down on pre-COVID numbers, even at the end of this year. And, you know, one concern for us is that there is a risk that the recovery could run out of steam a little bit as we get to the end of the year, as, you know, the squeeze from the labour market hits consumption, consumer demand and household spending. Because although we have an unemployment rate which is pretty much unchanged over pre-pandemic levels, what we've learned also from figures out this week from labour market numbers is that this doesn't represent the true picture, that lots of people have just opted out of the jobs market for now and moved into inactivity, and clearly their household financial positions will be affected by that. So, look, a lot of data still confirming our suspicion that the recovery is picking up pace and will continue to do so through Q3, but clearly some significant risks there, certainly over Q4 and beyond. And, you know, clearly we continue to watch the evolution of the virus and the impact that the government has to take, the responses the government has to take as those virus numbers evolve. Now, I want to make a few final points. Firstly, on virus watching, we're seeing lots of focus on rising UK case numbers. That's, you know, clearly still important, as are the reinfection rate numbers. But also importantly now, given the focus on localised lockdowns, is the spread of the virus. So obviously, if you've got a lot of cases in one place, the economic implications of that now with the focus on localised lockdown is probably less, because the government is going to try and lock down a particular area rather than, you know, it will do everything it can to avoid that big national lockdown once again and try to be a bit smarter about the way it manages and contains the virus. Secondly, on interest rates, we had a big interest rate meeting and policy report from the Bank of England last week. There's still quite a lot of focus on whether we could see a negative bank rate. There was a focus box in the report from the Bank of England last week, which suggests that the bank is still resisting this. It hasn't ruled it out, but it favours using more quantitative easing, which particularly has dealt with some of the market strains which emerged, such as in the gilt market earlier this year. But that quantitative easing and things like forward guidance, it indicated last week, remain a key focus for the BOE rather than negative interest rates at this point. And I think, you know, our position has been that it would take a much more material shift in the economic backdrop as we move into next year to persuade them that negative bank rate is something that they want to do. They are concerned about the side effects, such as through implications on bank profitability and therefore bank lending from going there. And then very finally on Brexit rather, the transition period for Brexit ends December 31st. The clock is obviously ticking, therefore, for a free trade deal. Talks are paused now for the summer, but there has been a notable shift in tone over the last couple of weeks, where, say, Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove is sounding a bit more optimistic that they're getting some movement from Brussels on the red lines. We heard Chancellor Rishi Sunak talking about a deal coming through in September time. So it may be that after a lot of bad news, certainly some pretty negative headlines this morning, that perhaps on Brexit, and certainly at least on the near-term economic numbers as they catch up with what's been happening we do start to see some slightly more positive signs. Thank you very much. I will pass over to Kieran now for his thoughts on the foreign exchange front. Kieran, over to you.
Thank you, Victoria, and hello, everybody. I hope you're all well and are enjoying the summer heat rather than melting away in it like I have been in my home office this week. As Victoria mentioned, I'm going to be talking to you about the big themes that have emerged in currency markets, certainly since our last webinar, as well as give you a flavor of the type of flows we've seen from our corporate client base as they've looked to manage these currency fluctuations. Finally, we'll take a moment to look forward to see what's to come. For those of you that follow the market, you won't need me to tell you that it's been an unbelievably interesting time in currency markets over the last few weeks. The dollar has been the main protagonist without any shadow of a doubt, and I will endeavor to explain why in a bit. Let's start by looking at the sterling dollar rate, or cable as we call it, as movement this year in cable highlights just how unpredictable markets have been. Sterling dollar started the year at the lofty height of 132. It then dropped 14% to 114 in March when the UK went into full lockdown recall before clawing its way back up into a whippy range-bound period within the green lines. In this period, risk sentiment was decidedly mixed as investors struggled for direction between improving economic data as the economy opened up on the one hand, and rising COVID cases on the other. The final 7% gain, well, that's only happened since June, where cable peaked at 131.86 last week. More tellingly, the final 5% of that appreciation came only in the last 2 weeks of July. On the corporate FX desk, it's meant that July was one of the busiest months we have ever seen. In volume terms, the month of July equaled the highest volume month ever. In terms of hedging activity, predictably, the vast majority of this was conducted by dollar buyers. Most dollar buying hedging portfolios were underweight going into the month, leading clients to layer in new deals, typically targeting levels at or above 130. Even more conservative clients were keen to ensure hedges offered participation to levels well above 130. Meaning the split of flexible to fixed hedging was heavily skewed towards flexibility, as the average number of clients that hedged with FX options-based strategies more than doubled in July versus previous months in 2020. We were also seeing clients happy to hedge further out than previously, with the volume-weighted tenor of hedges in our corporate book moving 89 days further out on average than the tenor we'd seen in the previous 6 months. Whilst hedging activity was certainly high, people were still left scratching their heads as to why the dollar weakened in July against a backdrop of rising US COVID cases. The anticipated flight to safety investment flows into the safe haven dollar, which happened back in March, didn't happen this time. Instead, the dollar weakened not only against the pound, but across the board, with the DXY or dollar index dropping 5% in the month of July. The DXY, remember, measures dollar strength against a basket of currencies. So the question is, why did we not see the dollar strengthen on rising COVID uncertainty? And closer to home, why did we not see sterling dollar move lower when there was little progress on the Brexit front? Well, there were a number of contributing factors. First and foremost, there was also a massive euro rally. It all really happened on the 21st of July. That was the date when the leaders of the 27 European Union struck a unanimous deal on a huge coronavirus recovery package, offering $750 billion in grants and loans. This sparked a raft of investor flows out of the dollar and into the euro, with euro-dollar reaching 119 last week, a level not seen since 2018. Around the same time, we saw risk on dollar selling as news broke of encouraging data from early stage human trials of a vaccine developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, where it was reported that a jab could be ready by early next year. Further to this, negative real rates in the States pushed investors to look at other asset classes too. For instance, risk-averse investors moved into safe havens such as gold, whilst coincidentally trading at all-time highs last week. and those with a higher risk appetite moved into equities where dividend yields are still achievable. Finally, there were monetary policy and fiscal policy reasons too. On the former, the Federal Reserve had suggested they will keep policy accommodative for some time in order to help the U.S. economy pick itself up. And on the latter, the failure of Congress to get the U.S. virus relief package over the line before it broke for recess at the end of last week put the dollar under further pressure. As for the sterling side, the pound certainly benefited from the fact that the economy started to open up further, with month-on-month data improving as a result. Whilst there were and continue to be localized lockdowns and we do need to keep an eye on the rising cases, for the time being, the market is watchful rather than being overly concerned by this. With regards to Brexit news, a lack of movement in July did little to hinder the pound's progress. I suppose no news is good news, and as Victoria mentioned, we have seen some positive sound bites from Michael Gove and the like. So it is very much watch this space. But on monetary policy too, Bank of England members, including the Governor Bailey, have on more than one occasion mentioned that negative rates are not appropriate for now, and this has taken the edge of concerns that this could be a viable policy tool, certainly in the second half of the year. So the question is, where do we go from here? What is on the horizon, and what are the bank forecasts telling us? Well, at the start of July, the median view of 83 financial institutions polled by Bloomberg had sterling dollar at 125 by the end of this quarter, 126 by the end of quarter four, 128 by the end of quarter one, and by mid-year next year, they had it at 129. These now stand a touch higher across those dates, with the median view now at 127, 128, 129, and 130. So yes, the current sterling dollar spot rate is already above the current median market forecast going out to June 21, implying that the amount of dollar weakness that we have seen in the last few weeks has definitely caught the market out by surprise. Outside of the macro data and the big news, well, big COVID news rather, which seems to be a slugfest now between second wave threats and positive vaccine news, there are, however, plenty of other things to watch out for. We often talk about the US-China trade war, but is there a UK-China war of sorts brewing? The UK said that it will provide a path to citizenship for potentially millions of Hong Kong residents as a result of the new security laws which China has unveiled. Plus, there has also been a complete U-turn by the government on using Huawei as a 5G network provider. Also, keep an eye on the unemployment data. With the furlough scheme ending in October, reports suggest a third of UK employers might have to lay off workers once the scheme ends, which clearly will not be good news for the wider economy or the pound. And finally, of course, there is that little hurdle called Brexit that still needs to be climbed over. Whilst the UK has been sending out those positive sign bites recently, we all know how quickly things can turn around there. Stateside, I've already mentioned the US-China trade war. Tensions continue to escalate as Trump this week imposed sanctions on 11 Chinese and Hong Kong officials. Speaking of Trump, he also has a small matter of a US election to navigate. Whilst President Trump correctly pointed out that the US has less coronavirus cases than the world in a recent interview with Axios, his COVID policy undoubtedly has played a part in the slide in his poll ratings. As such, it came as no surprise that Trump decided to change his COVID strategy. After all, the US has less than 4% of the global population, but accounts for more than a fifth of the world's COVID deaths. In July, he started to wear a face mask in public for the first time, and he also suggested that perhaps it wasn't a bad idea for others to wear one too. He also reinstated the coronavirus briefings, and now that numbers have begun to stabilize in the US, are we all in for a surprise at the upcoming November election? Perhaps like a professional athlete coming round the bend in the 400 meters, he's timing his sprint perfectly and is about to pitch Biden to the line in that race to the White House.